companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Hey Onions Talk listeners, if you're enjoying this podcast, do consider supporting me on Patreon. This work is unfunded, but a lot of work goes into organizing these interviews, editing the audio, and doing communications and publicity. Every bit counts in helping me continue Onions Talk. So do consider supporting on Patreon at FIENEO. You can also find a link in this episode's show notes. Your support will allow me to sustain the work I'm doing. Thank you for tuning in. Enjoy this episode.
My name is Laura Francois. I am an impact strategist and designer by training or by trade, and a founder by, I guess, by nature. I am the co-founder of something called The Spaceship, which is a program, an education program for misfits and rebels all over the world who want to solve big, challenging world problems through business. So we basically teach individuals how to think about global impact and how to think about entrepreneurship, and launch something that can solve for some of the many challenges. We have no shortage of challenges. I'm also the co-founder of something called DemoPunk. We're essentially a startup that connects carbon sequestering products to the real estate industry so that we could start building buildings that suck all of our ugly carbon from the planet. So those are my two hats that I wear and have been floating around both Canada and Singapore for quite some time now. And I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you, Laura. You know, you are the right person I need right now. Just because it's so difficult in the social impact space. I've been in the nonprofit sector and different sort of NGO social sector. And, you know, at the bottom of it, you realize that fundamentally, if so much effort is put into raising the funds to do the work, and then the funds just kind of go into your administration, bureaucracy, logistics, and then the impact evaluation report instead of the actual work on the ground, in the long run, you're looking at something that might not be actually that sustainable in terms of real impact work. And then when you try and figure out a way to make things work financially for something that has the social impact but benefits people who might not necessarily have the financial power to pay for it, then things become really complicated and tricky. And then how do you support the people who are doing the work? And, you know, if you want to do the work properly, it's a full-time job. It's not a part-time thing that you just volunteer 1 or 2 hours a day. And, you know, it's so difficult on so many different levels. But anyway, we'll do this sort of like strategically, slowly kind of charting your journey, because I'm really curious. So you're from Canada, and then you went to Southeast Asia, somehow managed to make things work, and you did so many incredible things. Like you started, you co-founded a social enterprise, an impact design studio, led international impact projects, ran global nonprofit fashion revolution in Singapore and Malaysia. And then you kind of went from Singapore and back to Canada now. But then what was your journey like? How did you manage to navigate the different systems in Southeast Asia and manage to find all these different ways and resources to make things work?
Well, I started off as a student. I was studying at NUS in Singapore during my undergrad. I really fell in love with Singapore for a lot of reasons, but and the region. And thought it was just a really interesting place to work on system strategy. So system strategy, in a nutshell, for those who are new to the term, it's just basically trying to figure out how things are connected to each other. So when we talk about environment or we talk about social issues, I mean, we talk about anything, Black Lives Matter, whatever, anything on the planet that is currently existing can connect to others in really sometimes very surprising ways. And the more we understand those connections, the more efficient we can be just as humans, but also in the work that we do. So not just tackling one thing, but making sure we're hitting as many birds with one stone, if you will. I should probably use a different term, because hitting birds with stones is not a very environmentally conscious way of speaking. Anyway, find another analogy there. So to answer your question, or to kind of come back to the journey, I actually started very much as a activist and as a human who never thought that anything will change unless you work for a nonprofit or you work for the UN. My goal in life was like, I'm going to work for the UN and I'm going to change things. And very, very quickly realized that works for some people, but unfortunately the nonprofit space it doesn't learn very much from you know, how to iterate and how to grow and how to change really quickly on the fly. And that's something that you need if you're going to survive, and especially when you're focused on really difficult problems. So when it comes to even like fundraising, so the way nonprofits work, right, is you fundraise, you have all this money, you put it towards, you know, the cause that you're raising for, the project you're raising for, but it doesn't sustain. It doesn't sustain itself. So the next year, the next, you know, season, you have to do the same. And unfortunately, that causes a bunch of ripple effects in the system. So going back to systems thinking, like, it causes a lot of social problems. I'll give you an example. You know, the fact that there are projects that have existed, that have been funded, and then kind of left 6 months later, means that the individuals that were relying on that project all of a sudden can't access them, or the project doesn't work anymore, or from anything, you know, building a well in an area that doesn't have any accessible water. If you don't upkeep that well, what's going to happen to the well? You know, if it breaks down, if it doesn't work. And so that's my jaded point of view on my experience working with nonprofits. Not to say that there isn't space for them. There definitely is, but that's kind of what turned me on a different track, and I started looking at the potential for social and environmental businesses to take the role of solving for those issues. And Southeast Asia has more entrepreneurs that maybe don't even realize that they're entrepreneurs, or don't necessarily call themselves entrepreneurs, solving for some of these really big problems that there are more entrepreneurs than I've ever seen in my life in one region. What was interesting is like being able to map the impact of these of individuals, not just in Singapore, but I was also working in Malaysia for some time, Cambodia, Vietnam, and mapping out like what can happen when you equip somebody with the right mindset around being able to sustain yourself and the project. You mentioned something really interesting when you were rambling about all of your disdain around there's not enough funding, there's not enough opportunities. And the truth is, if you build a project, whether it's an impact project or not, if you build a project that is solving something well, it will find the funding will come to it. Whether it be through an investor, whether it's through a partner, or just customers who just want what you're building. And I think a big misunderstanding around the impact space is that it has to be a company or a product or a project that just does impact stuff. But those projects don't survive either, because nobody just wants to buy something to do good. You might want to do that once or twice, but nobody has the time, bandwidth, or money to keep buying something just because it makes you feel good, because you're doing something good for the planet. Buying something that you actually want or need or makes you feel good or joyful or that's beautiful or useful will always be the main reason, motivation for humans to interact with projects, right? And so it kind of revolutionized my life when I realized that, because I had, as an activist, realizing that, yeah, I can keep saying the same things and trying to get people to move the needle, you know, one inch forward, but unless it's actually motivated by, again, what the private sector has been doing all this time with selling products. And unless I'm using those same tactics, the same marketing tactics, the same brand building tactics, I'm not going to win at this game. And so it's about, so for me, my journey in Southeast Asia, and very much now just having come back to North America, has been that of just learning the language of both this impact side and this business side, because it's the only way that things move. So that's my little two cents around my personal journey. Maybe my journey had very little to do actually with geography, and very much just to do with translating one sector to another.
Something that I realized in the business space and sort of in the social enterprise space, I feel like the motivations are really different. When you have business principles that is really just profit maximizing, and then looking at things from a social impact angle where you are not really looking at that sort of exponential growth, but really how can you sustain the sort of impact work while still having this sort of income to do the work. And like my experience in a business course is that there are things that are useful, but not everything is transferable. And it's very difficult to bridge between the social impact world and the business world when, you know, all of it is just teaching about how do you maximize profit, how do you scale and blah, blah, blah. And they don't actually consider ethics or, you know, exploitation of resources or anything about that, because it was just about, you know, mostly maximizing your revenue, cutting your cost. And I wonder if you have any sort of thoughts around that, and also like bridging of language between different sectors. I think the way that we speak and the way that we understand the work that's being done in a nonprofit, it's a lot about impact, which, you know, it's not just quantitative, it's also qualitative, it's also relationships. Yet when speaking with businesses, from what I've learned so far, it's a lot about KPIs and numbers and data, like how can you justify the impact that is being done, and then what kind of numbers are you looking at, and if I can quantify that, then it's worth the support. Which, coming from the sort of arts perspective, so much of the work, it's about opening up conversations, difficult conversations, and raising awareness, but then also, you know, like planting seeds so that people would question things and think about things differently, and then hopefully inspire action. And then also through socially engaged arts processes, to then have this sort of process where people would build those relationships, and then hopefully, you know, from there on to be able to build something from there, which, you know, it's very difficult to say like, oh, after this conversation or this discussion or this project, X amount of people, you know, were converted and inspired and they are like, you know, starting their own stuff, because it happens in many different miraculous ways that we cannot necessarily measure. Yet it's not to say that there is no point in doing this kind of work that is capacity building and that, I guess, awakens, I'm not sure if that's the right or good word, but then allows people to think a bit further or deeper about the situation that we live in. Yet when thinking also about sort of business spaces and what we sell, I think non-consumption is best for the planet. So then if we don't want to sell products, if we look at selling services, it almost feels like there needs to be a fundamental cultural shift and a shift in the way that we value things, or the way that we value what we would spend our money on, to be able to allow for that sort of consumption in these kinds of services to be adopted. So then it almost feels like a chicken and egg thing. You know, if you don't change the culture, then people are not going to shift the ways that they buy things, even if they have the purchasing power. But then if you don't have the sort of income coming in, then how do you do the thing that shifts the culture?
Okay, you touched upon so many different things. Is there a specific question or angle you want me to enter this on? Because there's so many different ways I could do this.
I guess value, you know, when you are offering something that has this sort of social impact, that has potential for social transformation, but then it's not necessarily able to be measured in your sort of data ways, yet there is value in that. And then the sort of culture not quite being there yet to pay for these services. So then how do you go about doing it? It's a difficult question.
Okay. So let's start here. Is everything that's valuable measurable? No. Love. The way I love somebody, I can't measure, but it is probably the most important and biggest thing I can ever give somebody. And I think of art the same way. Love and art, what connects both of them is that they are a renewable resource. You can give as much as you want and you will always have more to give in terms of creativity, in terms of your artistic process. Yes, you might go through dry spells or times where, yeah, you have a block, but it is still a renewable resource. Does that necessarily mean that it's easy to fund stuff that is not measurable? No, absolutely not. Every art project, so I've collaborated, I'm actually extremely, though I don't consider myself an artist, I'm extremely fascinated by artists, and I collaborate with them oftentimes because they can communicate what it is that I'm trying to say from a awareness building perspective much better than I can, because it's intangible. Because it hits heartstrings, because it talks to people on a human level better than any figure, number, data, statistic can ever do. And so art and artists are my Trojan horse to get into conversations that are difficult to have with stakeholders that are difficult to communicate to. So that's to me, that's something important to recognize. However, I think that just saying that, oh, I'm ahead of my time, or nobody understands me, or I'm creating art, or I'm creating a product that like doesn't have any real financial value, but I know it's going to do something impactful. There is room for that, but I also don't want to make it look so black and white, because the truth is that we need change at scale. And when things happen at scale, whether you're a nonprofit, whether you're a government, whether you're a business, it will be about numbers, because it has to be. Because if it's about the individual, even when you're scaling, let's say we're, okay, it's COVID. We're talking about vaccines these days. Still waiting to get mine. Many people are waiting to get theirs. If it was about the human experience getting a vaccination, we wouldn't be at the place we're at right now, vaccinating in the numbers that we're vaccinating. It has to be cut and dry. It has to be data driven. And that's impactful in this moment. And the same can be said for delivering emergency goods and water and food. So when we can't just look at impact as something that is very black and white, it has to be something personal, or it has to be something unquantifiable, or vice versa. And so I just want to make that point there, because there are some really amazing companies that are incredibly impactful who don't consider themselves an impact company, who don't even measure their impact, but their impact is widely felt. And I'll remind people here, impact doesn't necessarily mean good. Facebook is an incredibly impactful company. Incredibly, probably one of the most impactful companies of our decade. Impact is positive and negative. It's up to the person spearheading this, the designer of the mission, the designer of the product, to be able to try to mitigate how much good versus how much bad. And that is true for business, that is true for art, that is true for nonprofits. Because just because you're a nonprofit and you might have labeled yourself as a do-gooder does not mean that you don't have negative impact in the process. Just because you're an artist that is creating environmental art, if you're creating that art with a specific process that requires a lot of energy and a lot of resources that are unrenewable and basically, if you're creating a system for yourself to create an art piece that essentially is creating more negative impact and creating a larger footprint in the process of doing that, you have to sit there for yourself and try to quantify that. Even though it's unquantifiable, try to quantify that. And unless you're having those questions, no matter who you are, what sector you're in, we're never going to reach a place where we can start making better decisions. So it's not as black and white in terms of businesses doing bad and nonprofits and social designers are doing good. It's that if we're not thinking about what negative might be happening while we're doing a positive, we're always going to be sitting in the same place. I want to give a quick example. I knew somebody a client of mine wanted to create leggings, wearable leggings to exercise in, out of plastic. This is like 8 years ago when no one was really doing this yet. And it was like, we're going to take plastic water bottles and we're going to transform this into fiber. And then we're going to make leggings. And we're going to sell these as recycled leggings. Amazing. They ran out of water bottles. So they started creating empty water bottles to produce fibers, to produce leggings. Yes, there were recycled water bottles, but where did you get those water bottles if you had to produce them yourself? Does that really fall in line with what it is that you're trying to do? And so this is a question that everyone needs to ask themselves through their work at every stage. It's not just at the beginning of the inception of the idea. It's at every stage. So that's my little two cents on the impact stuff. And I just want to quickly address another point that you made around, well, it's really hard to get things funded when it's really hard to get things funded when it's just an impact project or it's an art project. I think there is tons and tons and tons of funding available out there, not necessarily for the impact space. So instead of waiting for funding to arrive in the impact space or funding to arrive in the artistic space, start creating things that people really want. And that sounds like a cop-out. That sounds like a, oh man, now I need to go mainstream. Now I need to start, you know, marketing my stuff as, you know, whatever these corporates want. No, but if we're going to change things at scale, isn't working with a very large corporation, very large multi-million dollar conglomerate, and enabling them to leverage great artists, great impact entrepreneurs, and finding places of collaboration, even if it's not 100% true to your artistic vision, or it's not 100% true to what it is that you've set out to do, there's still a lot of positive impact at play in doing those types of collaborations, and there's funding available for that. So it's about reframing what it is that you want to do.
I have some thoughts around corporates and greenwashing.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, if that gives you the resources to do the things that you want to do, do you then just take it on anyway? Because if you don't, you might just end up not being able to do stuff.
Okay. I would never condone greenwashing. And if you feel there are different ways to spot greenwashing, and if you feel like you've spotted it, don't go near it ever. Because if your work is associated with a greenwashing project of any kind, there's no going back from that. So your reputation is something that is non-renewable. So don't approach greenwashing projects ever. But when I say collaboration with corporates, I don't necessarily mean like those who are trying to greenwash. There are fantastic organizations that work at scale who don't have creative teams, who don't necessarily even have a marketing team, who might not have even ever created a campaign, but that are doing the world-changing stuff. I'm going to give you a really lame example. Though the organizations that are silently operating the planet are oftentimes those who work in the canola oil industry. It's very random, but the oil industries that basically make us, you know, our ketchup and our, all of our food products, all of our cosmetic products, all of the, like, everything that we use, Unilever, like all of these companies, right? The companies that are trying to reinvent, there's actually a company out of Singapore called Sipure, and they're a startup that is basically reinventing, it's not sexy, guys, it's reinventing the way we create oils, basically the process of creating oils, so that we can decrease the carbon footprint of this production. And if you do that, you have the potential of basically halving the carbon footprint of our planet. This is not something we're talking about. This is because it's boring. It's like, okay, yeah, okay, there's oils in my makeup. How we get that oil, I don't really care. I don't really think about it. But the companies who are doing stuff like that, those are the companies that don't have a marketing team, don't know how to necessarily storytell what they're doing, or in the sense that, you know, they're not public facing. They're dealing with a very B2B, business to business stakeholder structures and relationships. But those are the types of organizations that it's worth investigating. So doing your due diligence and trying to find the real change makers out there, they are open to collaborations. So it's not necessarily the most obvious, but you have to just do your research. And again, it's so much about using your superpower, your art, your creative strategy to help leverage those who are doing the very data-focused, scale-focused work in this world that is making its mark. I'm not saying that artists are not as worthy as these researchers and scientists, but unless they work together to actually try to amplify each other's work, yeah, you're working in these two silos that unfortunately the scientists are never going to get their word out there as well as an artist would and really touching people about their work. And an artist is never going to make the type of impact at scale that the scientist would. So that's what I'm talking about.
What were some of your strategies? How did you manage to reach these people from the beginning? What made you even start thinking about this direction?
I think for me, it was about trying to identify which industries were not necessarily the top of the iceberg. So everyone's talking about when I was running Fashion Revolution in Malaysia and Singapore. I mean, it was and it still is a very sexy topic. Everyone loves talking about the sustainable fashion stuff. However, there is out of the sustainable fashion stuff, what was really interesting to me was the water pollution side, because the water pollution side and even the fiber technology side was where it was at. I mean, you can talk all day about how secondhand clothes is important, but at a certain point, unless a scientist is coming up with new ways to create fiber recycling technology, we're not really going to, you can shop at a thrift store all you want, but we're not going to get where we need to be in terms of our climate goals. And so to me, it was just about digging deep in the subjects that I thought were interesting. So fashion or food or whatever else, and try to actually figure out, do your own research, assess where it is that the most potential for impact is happening, and then figure out, who's doing that stuff and approaching those guys. Trying to really assess, like, who are the key players? And I'm telling you, in Singapore, there is way more happening than meets the eye when it comes to startups, businesses that are really trying to tackle these root cause problems. And what I think is most fascinating about trying to figure out your root problems or trying to identify root problems is that once you get there, you realize that everything above, though it's important in the system and it moves things forward, they're all band-aid solutions. And when we talk about impact at scale, band-aid solutions have a very limited shelf life when in the grand scheme of things. So a very tangible, so this is something we teach at the Spaceship, is this 5 whys strategy. So anytime that you're trying to identify a root cause, go for the 5 whys, and it works like this. So what is the problem you're interested in tackling? So I'm interested in tackling the fast fashion space. Okay, why is fast fashion happening? Well, because, I don't know, let's think of something random. Fast fashion happens because people love trends. Okay, why do people love trends? Well, because people are addicted to social media and people are very susceptible to looking at other folks and getting jealous. Okay, why are people so addicted to social media? Now we're getting into something interesting. We're only at the 4th why. If you go all the way down to the 5th one, I bet you'll find something really cool. And so when we start talking about people's addiction to social media, you can actually start solving for why fast fashion is so shitty without realizing it, but you're actually tackling something that's way more impactful than just going out there and telling people stop buying clothes. Because sure, some people will say, okay, sure, thank you very much for that piece of information, I'll stop buying clothes. But if you actually help them figure out why they're addicted to social media, which is making them addicted to buying clothes, you're talking about a long-term effect.
So exciting. You just opened my eyes to a whole new different perspective out there that intersects different sectors, yet also allows a place for the arts to be able to do more good. And it's almost like fitting the puzzles it all together. And also like the sort of 5 why strategy, it reminds me also of certain therapy techniques where, you know, if you have a certain emotion, if you're feeling really angry about certain issue, why are you feeling angry? When something comes out, what is the next why and the next why and the next why? And then so you get to the root of the problem, which, you know, sometimes links to your childhood or whatever that is. Something that I am also really passionate about is that I think a lot of young people who are concerned, who are aware, who want to do something to make a difference, often don't have the resources or don't know how or where to start, or that they find themselves in a position where they started something, but then they cannot sustain it and they don't find the right tribe to be in to be able to support them to move forward. And it kind of feels like there isn't an ecosystem of change makers out there that is supportive, that crosses between different sectors to then actually be able to like guide people through that journey and process. And so often people just burn out along the way. And how long could you sustain that if you are kind of like in your own circles and, you know, with people who are maybe not very supportive of your cause around? And how could we sort of change this or create more supportive environments for this? I wonder if you have any thoughts on this.
I empathize. I mean, shout out to anyone who's feeling like they have no tribe or they feel like a total misfit. Like, yes, recognizing that. And not about to tell you it's all going to be fine. You'll find your people. Sometimes you do. A lot of times you don't. That doesn't mean you should give up on what it is that you're doing. I was going to say that sometimes it happens in the most unexpected places. I've very rarely found my tribe with like if I say like, oh, you know, I'm an impact entrepreneur. I'm going to go hang out where all the impact entrepreneurs hang out. Yeah. Sometimes I'll find some really great nuts in there, but I've always been very surprisingly, I don't know, taken aback by finding, chaos particles, like finding people in really unexpected places. When you sit there long enough and you focus long enough on what it is that you're doing, I wouldn't have started collaborating with artists if I had stayed in the impact measurement, impact strategy space, right? And so being, you know, letting yourself be that adventurer, I call myself a cross-pollinator. It's the only way I can really start. And I came across this word very recently as being like, oh, that's how I feel. Because yeah, I don't stay on one flower for very long. And it doesn't mean I'm flaky. And it doesn't mean that I don't like that flower. It just means that I actually derive more inspiration, more focus, more energy when I am hopping from flower to flower and I'm cross-pollinating. And what it is that I can leave behind, whether it's in an industry I don't know, whether it's an industry I know little about or I'm jaded by or whatever else, I think that whatever happens at the intersection of worlds is much more interesting than staying in your world. But that means it can be very lonely. That's just the reality of it. So I guess I don't have a solution, but I will say that putting yourself in new spaces is more likely to bring you to interesting projects, interesting opportunities. I didn't just happen on being able to starting to like think about art with scientists. Like that just didn't happen. I had to start hanging out with scientists. I need to start hanging out with founders who are doing stuff that I didn't understand, that I was like, please explain this to me. Like I'm a 2-year-old. Unless I was able to do that and had the encouragement of other people to say, yeah, go try it out, I wouldn't have done it. And I would have still been hanging out with, again, the impact strategy folk, which I love, by the way, shout out to all my impact strategy people. But again, the cross-pollination factor is what's interesting. I think especially artists will understand, you understand this. Like you have to put yourself into scenarios where you're shocked, you're excited, you're curious. And so, yeah, don't try to find a tribe. Try to find pockets that you can float between. I think that's what's important. And whether that's in Singapore or anywhere else, I think especially the last couple of years, what's great is that people are realizing that there's benefit in bringing more creative folks in, because we wouldn't have survived this pandemic without the creative folks, without the artists, without, what did we all do? We all watched Netflix. We were all scrolling on Instagram. We were all consuming art and creative stuff. So I think there's been a shift. I have recognized a shift where there are a lot more doors open for creatives to just come in and have a seat at the table. Even if it's just to observe, even if it's just, and so take that invitation, even if it's lonely. That's my suggestion.
Thank you, Laura. You just answered a big question of mine without realizing it, because I've been trying to organize cross-sector conversations in Singapore and actually also internationally, just to bring together people who are passionate, who want to do something to make a difference and come from completely different fields, because somewhere in there will lie the opportunities for things to cross-pollinate and for financial opportunities to arise for people who don't necessarily have that. And it's just been so difficult to put it across, I think also because I don't have the clarity of what is going to come out of it. What exactly is the sort of impact that can come from this space? But you just so clearly illustrated that, you know, if you just put like two different pieces that don't usually match together, but then they're all sort of going towards a certain mission, then there could be sparks in there that could bring each project forward even further and bring that impact to a space that is much larger and wider. And this next question that I want to ask is about focus. Because I think a lot of times for change makers, especially when you're just starting out, when you care about everything that's happening in the world, it's very difficult to just focus on one thing. And also the more that you switch between different domains and fields and sectors, the more it feels like, you know, people look at you as though, well, you just don't have focus. And then you might think that you have some focus, but then actually your mind is everywhere buzzing around all the different dots that you're trying to connect. So then how did you manage to find your focus and really work on something?
I didn't. I think you just set me up for failure with that question. How did you find your focus? I'm like, brief history of the life of Laura. I started in end of life care. I started in palliative care services. Was really motivated by that. I had an amazing mentor in that space, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to work with people at the end of their lives. Then I didn't. Then I started doing corporate social responsibility. Then I did my master's in India and discovered nonviolent communication. And I was like, interesting, I'm going to work with activists and do nonviolent communication. Then I started realizing while I was studying that, then I realized the impact of the fashion industry because I was working close to production sites in India. So then I was like, okay, the fashion industry is my thing. So I started doing the fashion stuff. While I was doing the fashion stuff, I noticed that there was a lot of people who work in the fashion industry as garment factory workers who are refugees. And then I got really into the refugee space and I was like, migrant work is really interesting and migrant workers in Singapore. So that was my first like kind of focus. And then I was looking at Rohingya crisis that I was looking at. So that became a thing. Then after that, so it's just like, okay, then I did the refugee thing. Now I'm back in Canada. I'm working with entrepreneurs who were ex-garment factory workers because I think that there's an interesting piece to play in terms of education and business and women's education and business. And I just recently started a company in the real estate industry to do carbon sequestering products. Do I have a focus? I mean, I don't know. My mom definitely doesn't think so. but love you, mom. So I think the truth is every time, so this will happen when you're cross-pollinating, and this will happen when, especially with you, you're creating these conversations. Like you said, part of your mission is creating these conversations. And the benefit of it is you might discover something awesome. The downside is that you might discover something awesome, and that will lead you down a new rabbit hole and might require you to kind of shift focus. I don't believe in people who have had linear careers. I really don't. Because again, there's strength in understanding what's outside of your silo. That being said, people who are masters in their space, I think that there is real benefit in mastering skills, but not necessarily industry. So you can be a master creative director, a master illustrator, whatever it is, a master data scientist, but you don't necessarily have to commit to just being a data scientist for SaaS products in the food delivery space, whatever, right? And that's, I think, where the benefit, I'm coming back to systems thinking, which is, I think, is my biggest love of my life, is just this idea that no matter what you want to focus on, if you pick anything, you pick, I'm really interested in women's rights, like that's what makes me tick. The truth is more women are affected by climate change than anybody else, women and non-binary. So all of a sudden you're like, oh, my women's interest, my women's rights interest is directly related to environment. Okay, does that mean I should focus on environment too? You could, because all your knowledge and interest and experience in the women rights space can now completely and beautifully enter into the environment space, right? And so that's what so the great thing is you don't have to choose, but really choose what types of skills you want to master and what is it that you want to learn. That's where I think you should, that's where the honing in. Is it about learning how to craft great conversations because you want to be an expert podcaster? Is it about like being an expert facilitator? Great, be an expert facilitator, but that doesn't mean you have to choose an industry. I think that's an old way of thinking and even when we talk about the sustainable development goals that the UN put out right for 2030, like 2021, it's like crazy. But 2030, we're supposed to reach these goals. Number 17 is the most important goal out of all of them. So they range from, if you've never seen them before, it's those colorful blocks, right? They go no poverty, access to education, responsible production. Number 17 is partnerships for the goals. Most important one, because if the people who are focusing on like underwater, you know, preservation don't start talking to the guys who are working on education, we're going to have a problem. So that's the way I like thinking about it. And that also takes the weight off of my shoulders from going, Laura, you have to pick an SDG. You have to find that focus. It's not true, because that's not how we're going to solve them. So why should I be picking one? So that's my excuse. Maybe it doesn't work for everybody, but this is definitely my, this is what I've told myself and it's worked so far. So I'll let you know if it stopped working.
You know, it's so comforting to hear this from you, because that's literally, it echoed my journey. I was looking into women rights and violence and I was feeling really angry. And then looking deeper into violence, trying to understand the human condition and why that kind of violence was possible, I started researching into war, which led me from the refugee crisis to Vietnam War, and then back to Japanese occupation, started a documentary series on that, and then, well, couldn't continue because of COVID, and then I was working with refugees in France, and then started to really realize about the entire sort of climate situation and crisis, and then in there, you also learn about colonization, racism, and it's, everything connects. And then when you look at impact and evaluation or whatever, and it's just, you know, you have to just focus on one thing, and the ways that you write funding applications, it's also kind of get towards that way of structure. And when you tell everyone that everything connects and I'm not just focusing on one thing, people don't get it. But then you illustrate it so brilliantly that eventually, essentially, everything connects.
Okay, but here's the secret. Here's the secret. I'm so glad you brought this up. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody that everything connects, especially when it's on an application form. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues. Definitely tell the people you're working with about like mission, this, everything connects. But as soon as you want funding, if they are giving you, here's the secret. If they're funding refugee projects, if you're an education project, you're an environmental project, you can apply for the refugee project funding because it's interconnected. Make sure that you have a product, you have a side, you have an angle. And I'm not just saying write like a phony grant application to get funding that's supposed to be reserved for a refugee project, but it means that you, if you have that mindset, you can be nimble enough to say, okay, we're going to adapt this education project. We're not just going to make it about women and children. We're going to make it for any displaced human, any migrant human, maybe any migrant human that is affected. So any climate refugee, like you're able to then adapt what it is that you're doing specific to what is available, because unfortunately there are trends in funding. I hate that that's what it is, but that's what it is. And so you have to work with it. Instead of just saying like, oh no, I don't, this is not part of my category, adapt with it, because oftentimes that, a lot of times there's funding that just ends up going to either nobody or a project that doesn't even have real impact or legs or is able to grow. And so it's better to go towards somebody who's thinking in that systemic way, who's then able to adapt. So the secret is don't necessarily scream it from the rooftops.
I guess the question that I'm really wanting to ask through the focus question is how do you strategize in a way that allows your projects to be successful and has that kind of impact?
Woo, you're really getting to like the meat of it. They're not always successful, like definitely not always successful. And success can mean, I remember, so actually our mutual friend, the person who put us in touch, so collaborating with Ben Von Wong, who's like one of my best friends and insane artist. I remember walking off a project that I was so happy about. I was crying. I was just like, my emotions took over. I was like, this was the most amazing thing. And he came out of that going, it sucked. And I was like, what are you talking about? It sucked. For him, it was not a success. For me, it was. You have to figure out for yourself what success is. That's the first thing. Because if you don't figure out what success is, you're never going to be successful. If you don't actually write down, success will be, I want 500,000 people to like this piece of art on my Instagram, that's success, then you better focus on that. If success is, I want to be able to talk to three people about this topic more easily, and that's what my art's going to allow me to do, then that's success. But you have to write that down almost for yourself. It's the only way you can be benchmark. And then the other thing I'll mention is that like I've never successfully done something in isolation. I've never done something alone that has worked. Anything I've done alone has been kind of crappy or has taught me something, but like I've kind of chalked it up as just like experience. That was an experience. Finding partners. There's no, like there's benefit in learning on your own and honing in on your craft, but the only real way to make sure that you're putting all your, I don't know, to really use all the skills available to you is to really work with somebody else, with other people who can help you identify what those skills are, what is needed to make this happen. I don't know how to do everything. And the problem is with the impact space, you have to be able to work in a manner that adapts to what's needed very quickly. So if I say I've worked with refugees in Europe and the refugees in Indonesia are not the same. You can't blanket statement that with like, oh, I worked with refugees, so I know how to work in this space. We don't. So finding partners on the ground, especially if you can, as grassroots and as local as possible, is the only way for you to ensure that you have the most potential for positive impact. And so, yeah, no matter where I've been, I mean, I'm thinking of the project I did in Egypt. Like how was I? I'd never been to Egypt before. I flew in, we started working the next day on a project that was all hypothetical. We were creating an art project in the largest mall in the Middle East that I've never been to, with materials I've never used. Like, if you wait till you know everything or learn everything or get all your cards aligned, it's never going to happen. And so I've just learned that, like, I prefer to work with people who are smarter than me, better than me, more efficient than me. And I want to be the weakest link in every situation, because that means that I'm learning, and that means that the project has way more opportunity to be successful, because I have weaknesses galore. So that's my thought on it.
I mean, I think there is the personal success part, which is personal and it doesn't matter for anyone else anyway, at least for me. And then there is the other part where, you know, when you put into pitch decks or proposals, there is the kind of numbers that funders will look for. And how do you submit that in? Like, what kind of stuff do you write in there? Like, how do you approach people? How do you get people to believe in the project that you're doing if you can't tell clearly what the outcomes would be?
Yeah. No, I. It wasn't until I started working with artists that I realized that process is more important than output, because output will be based off of so many different variables that nobody can control. And writing a proposal based off of the output is really, really putting you in a position that's kind of in a corner. It means, like, let's just take something basic and visual. Like, let's say you want to create a mural for a client. They're going to want to know what the mural looks like exactly before they fund you. You know, that might work, because you can create that. You can digitize that first. You can create a mock-up. Good, you're set. But if you're designing, I don't know, I'm even thinking some of the installation work we did, or even just when I design like projects that are like conversation projects or experiences, like, I don't know how that's going to happen. Like, I don't know if people are going to like it. I haven't done it yet. So the only thing that I can guarantee is the process. And that's something that I've learned to pitch, instead of, oh, you know, I'm pitching you this experience that people are going to rate 5 stars. People are going to walk out of there knowing exactly what the SDGs are all about. Here are all the things that they're going to learn. No, what I can promise you, though, is that they're going to have an experience that's unlike anything that your organization has ever done before. So there's novelty. I promise you something that, I don't know, is going to be extremely collaborative. People are going to feel empowered. I don't know how yet. I don't know through what. Maybe they'll be empowered by the visuals. Maybe it'll be the conversation they had. Maybe it'll be, but promising the experience, to me, is a lot easier to then engineer if something doesn't work out. If you're like, oh, we're not going to end up doing this, we're going that. I mean, you have to be the great thing and the most terrible thing about working with artists, in my opinion. No offense to you guys, but like, you change your mind a lot. There's a lot of like, we're not going to do this anymore. And I love that, because I'm a very I can be very numbers oriented and like plan focused. And so I love that, like, every 2 seconds, what I thought was going to happen is not going to happen. However, funders are oftentimes, or other partners are oftentimes, not like that. And so making sure that the plan is loose, the outcome is loose, but the process is very set. So the process is going to be this. People are going to walk through something, and experience one of these three things, then they're going to walk out and definitely feel whatever, curious or excited or this, that, the other. That I can guarantee, because that's what we're going to, that's what we're doing. So it's kind of just, it's being vague without showing that you're being vague, if I can put it that way. And trying to communicate to your, and it's also about picking the right partners, the partners who won't even look at you when you say that because they want exactly what's going to happen are not your right partners, because those are going to be the partners who are going to look over your shoulder every step of the way and want to see proof every step of the way. And that's probably not the right partner to collaborate with someone creative. And you don't necessarily want that, no matter how good the money is.
Yeah, that's pretty much selling the emotions. But also, you know, funny thing is that I was actually asking for a wall for a community project around my neighborhood from the PA. And they're like, so how's this going to look? What is it going to look like? And, you know, all that sort of details. And I drew something out. And then they have all these different considerations. Like for me, I don't care what I do. You know, I just want to get to people, have these conversations, build a community and build a circular economy from there. And then I think they have all these considerations about like, what if someone complains about the wall and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like the simplest thing that you can do, just give a wall for an art project. And it's suddenly this complicated thing. And it's just like, oh, it drives me bonkers.
Let me give you a piece of advice. Not that this will necessarily work, but having been in a similar situation, something that I thought was really interesting that someone, I forget who taught me this, but basically if you get the community involved, even though this is not a community project, you're the artist, you're wanting to paint on this wall. If they're saying, well, is the community going to like this? Or if you start bringing in a community component where you can even say, hey, I surveyed X amount of people in the neighborhood who walk by. I stood by this wall for a day and talked to every single person who walked by about this wall. Here, I recorded it for you. This is what they said. Here are some of the things that they said. I even asked who might want to collaborate. Does anyone want to provide me with photos for inspiration about what might go on the wall? As soon as it's a collaborative or a community, like all hands on deck, even though they might not be painting, it's still your artistic vision. It'll still be in your style. But people have given their two cents about, I'd love to have this or this included. It's so much more likely to get the attention of funders or even be ticked because they're like, oh, okay, she's done her due diligence, or like she's done the work for us to kind of validate that this might be something that people want. Even when it's not a community project, to just do that kind of shows in good faith that like, yeah, that you're open and it's not just about here, I want to paint this and it's only this. People like just feeling that, I don't know, comfort.
Interesting. That's a very good point. The first proposal I sent in was super loose. It was just, I want to talk to people and then I will decide what I'm going to paint from there because it's about hearing your stories. And they were like, no, I want to see how it looks like because Singapore just wants to see something that looks aesthetically pleasing enough to be considered art. It's just very conservative. But that's a very good point. I'll definitely work on that and then I'll let you know about it. We're running out of time, but I really want to ask this question, which is for young people who are starting out, what are some of your advice that you can give? And, you know, like if someone could do something to make a difference in this world, what would it be?
If you're going to do anything, do what you're good at. It's not, let's say you watched a documentary on Netflix about, I don't know, saving the whales, saving the octopus. And you're like, oh my gosh, I need now to go study like oceanography and I need to now become a scientist. You don't. If you're a fantastic graphic artist, you do that. You do that as best you can because that's going to be, again, coming back to my example of like collaborating with scientists or researchers or folks who are really in the nitty gritty of the problem, they need you. They need your superpower. So my main piece of advice is like, if you know you have a superpower, you're starting to uncover that, keep focusing on that. The change-making side, the what topic do I want to use to make good in this world, that can change. You can flip into and out of and get inspired by, but keep focusing on that thing that you do well. I wish someone had told me that because I've always morphed myself into what I thought I needed to be to get the job done. Ignoring what it was that I loved or ignoring what it was that I was good at, not realizing there was a place for that in impact making, impact building. So yeah, just don't let anyone tell you that you need to go do more schooling in a specific sector because you want to work in that sector. No, like, be the filmmaker, be the artist, be the facilitator, and then find pieces and connector pieces, partnerships with those industries, topics, fields that you're so passionate about. That's, yeah, that's what I wish my 15-year-old self could hear right now.
One last unexpected question. What is your favorite onion dish?
Onion dish? Oh my gosh, there's, I love onion dip for chips. You can make this with like onion soup mix and you just put it into like sour cream. I don't know if this is like a thing, but my mom always used to make that. I can eat raw onions anytime. I'm a big onion fan. That's actually the only reason I came on your show, because I just love onions. So I'm joking, but I do love onions. So yeah, onion dip.
Thank you, Laura, for your passion, your purpose, your motivation, your energy, and also it's just such good advice that anchors and helps people navigate forward, especially now in a time where everyone feels actually very quite lost, especially artists. And I think you provided some answers in there. So thank you. Well, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you. Thank you so much for this, and keep up the great work, VA. I'm always a big fan. So thanks for having me on the show.
Peel the layers and be the change. Onion's Talk podcast keeps you going when times are tough, and I crystallized learning that you can apply on your impact work to save you unnecessary struggles. Change making work is tough. Sometimes it feels like all the odds are against you, and it's a constant upward battle. My name is Fia, and I'm here to support you. If you're not yet on this journey, give Onion's Talk a listen. Be inspired, be touched, be motivated. I also run purpose discovery workshops online. Follow me on LinkedIn or Instagram at FEEYEH_NEO for updates, workshops, and future events. I also run a network called INSEP, International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, and we are always looking for partners and funders to continue cross-sector conversations and facilitate collaborations towards systems change. Check out my website at fieneo.art and get in touch if you'd like to work together. If you like this episode and would love to support, subscribe, leave a rating, write a review on iTunes, and consider donating. Your gift will allow me to continue supporting changemakers in a more sustainable way. Onion's Talk is on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcasting sites. If it's not there, send me an email at heyonionstalk@gmail.com. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode. Yeah.